information is free.
The law? Of course.
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
Tonight, we care, appear to border and it shows.
The law? Of course. The country.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
The government believed they were innocent. They have no idea what they're up against.
This is the storm of the century, they say. But will our natural national disaster be man-made? Welcome to episode 90 of MediaMonarchy.com. It's September 5th, 2008. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com, your source for news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. We got Palin, Gustav, and the Ron St. Paul rally, RNC police state then and democracy now, geopolitics, states of emergency, and international disasters, Mossad Nazis in barracks, explosions, atomic soldiers, 9/11 suicides, and anthrax predictive programming, surveillance psychosis, microchip cheese, and the end of the world on September 10th. It's all here. It's episode 90, MediaMonarchy.com. Going back a couple decades for that power pop classic from Big Star, that was September Girls, and we're going to be talking about some Septembers and some September Girls. Welcome Let me formally welcome you to episode 90 of MediaMonarchy.com. It's September 5th, 2008. My name is James Evan Pilato, coming to you, as always, live every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific time from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org. Sunday nights at 7 Eastern time on the Revere Radio Network, revereradio.net. KBFR in Boulder and Ground Zero Radio in Atlanta. Big thanks to those guys. You can hit me up on MySpace and Dig and YouTube and Yahoo and IM and Skype and all that with Media Monarchy as your keyword. And of course, iTunes, radioforall.net and archive.org. You can get the podcast anytime. So here we are again, my friends. Like one of our local city papers say, my, what a busy week. And we're going to see if I can cram all this news into the 2 hours. I spilled over. It was extra strength last week, 2.5 hours. Let's see if we can avoid that this time, but we'll see. We'll see how it goes. So there's tons to go over, and of course, we're going to hit it off with presidential selection 08. McCain, Palin, Gustav, and the RNC police state. So the first one we're going to hit, I think this kind of sets the stage, and appropriately enough, the article's called National Emergency Environment Sets the Stage for the McCain-Palin Election Campaign. This is from Michelle Chosadovsky over at globalresearch.ca. The opening of the RNC has been characterized by a mass protest movement directed against the Bush administration, the candidacy of John McCain, and more generally, the Republican Party. The presence of thousands of demonstrators in St. Paul, Minneapolis, has been a major factor in the Republican Party's decision to change the program of the RNC, using Hurricane Gustav as a pretext. And the article goes on, but it basically, they're setting the stage. So a McCain-Palin administration would be one always teetering on the edge of natural national disasters. So if we jump to the AP, RNC opens with appeal for Gustav aid. See, and that's the thing. So basically, they curtailed the first day's events this last Monday because they didn't want to seem like a bunch of dicks up in St. Paul living it up while people were running for their lives, and they didn't want a repeat of Katrina. So not only all of that stuff, but it also gives them the opportunity to say, oh, we're going to curtail tonight's events so that we can fly down and act like we care about people. What did Kanye West say? George Bush doesn't care about black people, I believe is what he said, much to Mike Myers' chagrin. But if we head over to the Washington Times, here's an interesting one, and it's going to be all up and down all the time. Dog and pony show. Follow the bouncing ball. Zogby poll puts McCain-Palin in the lead. So again, this is the Washington Times, the Mooney Times. The Sarah Palin pick for running mate about 16 hours after Obama's acceptance speech at the DNC is a gift John McCain gave to himself that doesn't quit giving, a new Zogby poll shows. The McCain pick has probably stunted any Obama Democratic convention bump, Mr. Zogby told the Washington Times. And you can link over and see that whole poll yourself. The Economic Policy Journal, brought to me by BlacklistedNews.com, points out something noteworthy. So the day of Sarah Palin's big coming out speech, which I guess was Wednesday, she canceled all her appearances for that day, ostensibly to study up, which I'm sure she needed to do, probably. However, she did make one little bit of meeting. So this Economic Policy Journal, except for a meeting with the pro-Israel lobby AIPAC, Sarah Palin appearances have been canceled, according to the Wall Street Journal. Quote, she has to familiarize herself with every position John McCain has ever held over a number of years. That takes work and briefing. And lots of mental gymnastics, I would imagine. She's been kept from contact with the media and others by Republican operatives. She had private sessions with Connecticut Senator Joe Israel First Lieberman and members of the pro-Israel group AIPAC. Remember, that's American Israel Public Affairs Committee. An AIPAC spokesman said Governor Palin told its members she would, quote, work to expand and deepen the strategic partnership between the U.S. and Israel. Now, there are tons more. And actually, yeah, I didn't mention at the top of the show. If you've listened to the show for very long, you'll remember that four times a year you'll hear me say, "Ah, I had to work last night. It was inventory." So last night was just such a night. So a little bit of this news. We're going to go all around the world, and it may not exactly be in order. But you can stick with me, and it's all up on MediaMonarchy.com. So the rest of the postings under this first hit is basically all the other things I didn't have time to flesh out. They're just pasted up. Big ugly links. But let's read some of those big ugly links, like November ballots include abortion issues. That's from the Washington Post. There's a lot about, and I won't be able to dive into it and do it all justice, but preemptive police raids on RNC protesters leads to investigation. That's from Raw Story. Total 411.info, before Gustav was asking the speculative question, do Brzezinski and Jindal plan a bio attack on Louisiana? However, what is not speculative is ID bracelets, and I believe they were barcode bracelets for people who need assistance leaving the Gustav Storm areas. So again, training people to have barcodes on them to be kept track of. And again, these things always roll out. It makes sense. Oh, well, that's reasonable. We need to keep track of people, but it's the slippery slope. So barcode bracelets, and that's coming from Cryptagon and InfoWars, and it sources back to mainstream media. Lots of clips, lots of videos. I'm only going to play some of the low points, as it were. Sarah Palin's Wikipedia page was scrubbed the moment she was announced to be the VP, which I broke for you last week on Media Monarchy. Minnesota Monster Mash, Police State Zombies in a Dead Republic. That's from Chris Floyd. Now, something we are going to hear, Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! Producers unlawfully arrested at the RNC. So there's lots of links and lots of video and lots of rebuttals. 283 arrested in Monday's RNC protest. I think basically the first day of the RNC, they arrested possibly more people than they did in the entire DNC. Time Magazine has pockets of violence at convention. Nearly 300 arrested. Glenn Greenwald over at Salon. Scenes from St. Paul. Amy Goodman arrested. Corporate news media cover police statism at the RNC. That's from the People's Voice. We got videos of police firing tear gas into protester groups. And then, of course, the GOP convention resuming with a Bush speech via satellite. And, of course, Lieberman was there. More videos of RNC protesters held without phone calls, medical attention. Gustav is gone, but the police state remains. Mayor and media silent on FBI raids of journalists and protesters at RNC. So let's get a little taste of what the protest sounded like, or at least what the mainstream media wanted us to think the protest sounded like.
And thanks for joining us today. I'm Angela Davis. We start with the images that took center stage on the first day of the Republican National Convention. Pockets of violence that overshadowed a mostly peaceful anti-war march and a downscale schedule at the convention itself. 283 people were arrested, 130 of them for felonies. Sue Turner was there this morning when they started to appear in court in Ramsey County. Hi, Sue.
Hi, Angela. Well, only two of those 283 people have gone through the court system and been charged. They both have been released on bail, but things are going much slower than I think anybody thought that they would. The court thought they would move several people who had been charged with misdemeanors through this morning, but there are some procedural items that are taking longer than they expected. Now, in this group that was supposed to move through the system this morning, 22 people would not give their names. They will be brought before the judge this afternoon and told that if they do not give their names, they will be held in criminal contempt. We do not know how long the judge plans to hold them. Now, we did meet one father who said his daughter was arrested at 5 o'clock yesterday afternoon and still had not been booked by this morning.
Police take down doors with guns drawn on families with their children at dinner time. Reporters and the media at large have been repeatedly targeted for repression. Activists have been abducted off the street in unmarked vans and political prisoners held without access to medical attention. The state has never really bothered with ethical justifications for its violence, but now we see that the agents of the law don't even bother with internal consistency, ignoring the few rights they have pledged not to violate.
There are no terrorists up here. There are no terrorists in the Ramsey County Jail. There are terrorists in the Excel Center. There are terrorists in the White House.
We recognize that we cannot work against systems of oppression unless we work on how those systems come and live and express themselves within us individually and in our communities.
There are no terrorists on this stage. There are no terrorists in the Ramsey County Jail. There isn't one of us. There isn't eight of us. And we stand together today.
I imagine you could almost say there are no terrorists, or at least ones that aren't provocateur triple agent patsies, but I digress. So if we go back to the ugly list of things under the Selection 08, McCain, Palin, Gustav, and the RNC police state, Sarah Palin is a Christian, and Christians support Israel. That's from israeltoday.co.il. Again, video of riot cops gassing RNC protesters, looking at America's police state. Clashes between St. Paul police and protesters bubble up online. That's from Threat Level. We also have from Danger Room, also on Wired.com, Predator spy drone on Gustav recovery mission. And we'll hear a little bit more about that later, using Global Hawk spy drones. RNC protesters charged as terrorists under Minnesota Patriot Act. Men held in convention bomb plot. And that was a man charged with threatening to, quote, blow up the GOP convention. That's from The Guardian. Activist claims unmarked police vans were abducting protesters. That's from Raw Story. Military resistance at the RNC. That's veterans against illegal wars. And last night, something I haven't had time to go into, as McCain's coronation happened last night, there were some montages. So apparently there was an RNC montage featuring some ominous 9/11 tribute that, of course, showed the flaming Twin Towers explode and collapse down in a big pile of aerosolized dust. As well, McCain also told the RNC last night, quote, change is coming. We've got Biden talking bad about AIPAC, which I'm sure he will retract quickly. New details about the plot to kill Obama, which we covered last week. This is coming from 9news.com. And there was even a little bit from Keith Olbermann marking the RNC 9/11 tribute as, quote, not appropriate. So we mentioned Amy Goodman, so let's hear it in her own words up on Free Speech TV talking about her arrest.
I'm Malia Brooker. You're watching Free Speech TV, and we are here with Amy Goodman, who was recently released. Tell us what happened with you and the other Democracy Now! Producers.
Well, Malia, I was arrested a few hours ago. I was actually on the convention floor talking to delegates at the Republican National Convention from Minnesota and Alaska, because Sarah Palin, the governor, has been nominated to be vice president. And I got a call on my cell phone that two of our producers, Shri Fotokadus and Nicole Salazar, had been arrested. So Rick Rowley, the videographer, and I raced down through the St. Paul streets to try to make sure that they would be released. And when I went up to the police officer and asked to speak to the commanding officer, they arrested me. They put me in handcuffs behind my back. They forced me down on the ground. Although I had all of my ID, you know, to get me onto the floor of the convention, you need top security ID. I had my Democracy Now! ID very clearly marked, and I had all of my identity. They took that from me. The Secret Service took my security ID for the convention, and they arrested me. They took everything from me. They brought me to the jail, which are they have these pens inside the police garage where we are put. But Nicole Salazar and Shri Fotokadus have gone to prison. They've been jailed and we need to make sure that they get out. They say they're charging them with a felony with PC. riot, which is probable cause riot. They are allowed to be held for 36 hours without charge. That would start at midnight tonight because it's Labor Day, which would be mean they would get out on Wednesday. This is unacceptable. We are there reporting on what is happening. It has been, there were major peaceful protests today in St. Paul. We're covering all of them. We come from New York, where the police have paid out hundreds of millions of dollars as a result of the kind of activity that we're seeing some of here after the Republican National Convention in 2004, when police just round up people wholesale. Sharif El-Quddus and Cole Salazar heard a commotion downstairs by 7th and Jackson here in St. Paul. Nicole had her camera. Sharif was with her. They were fully identified. When they saw the police converging from three places, it happened very quickly. Nicole said to one of the officers, "How do I leave?" They told her to go back. Before she could do this, and the video she has of this is very dramatic, they pushed her to the ground. They dragged her by her leg. She was scratched on her face, trying to keep her face up as they were dragging her. She got a bloody nose. When I was arrested and I was demanding to be able to see our producer, to see Sharif El-Quddus and Nicole Salazar, I said, "She has a bloody nose. I demand to see her." He said, "Listen, what's a bloody nose?" I was knifed. I said, "Sir, we were not responsible for that," meaning he was talking about a whole other time in his life. I said, "I am sorry that at some point in your life you were hurt like that, but that does not justify doing this to our reporter, to our producer. This is unacceptable. Reporters are the eyes and ears of the community. We cannot be threatened. We mustn't be jailed. There is a reason why our profession is the only one explicitly protected by the U.S. Constitution. We're supposed to be a check and balance on those in power. And there is no more important time than now."
Amy Goodman and the PC riots. Now, before I move on to the other side of the corrupt coin, and I think it's on the cover of the Oregonian right now that McCain is talking about change, although he, of course, doesn't mention what kind of change is coming. We're just left to shudder to think. But it's interesting to see the McCain-Palin campaign basically taking on the things they attack Obama, Biden for, whether it's lack of experience or change or yada yada. It's interchangeable. So, scroll down a little bit. Selection 08, Obama, Biden, herd the sheep. So, again, from Michelle Chosadovsky on globalresearch.ca, the Dems endorse the global war on terror, and Obama's going to go after Osama. Obama's American promise is war. American Promise being the name of his acceptance speech at the DNC. Barack Obama has embraced the GWAT, the Global War on Terror. The Obama-Biden campaign has endorsed the very foundations of the Bush administration's foreign policy agenda. Go after Osama bin Laden, take him out. The rhetoric is softer, but the substance is almost identical. Quote, "For a while, Senator McCain was turning his sights to Iraq just days after 9/11. I stood up and opposed this war, knowing that it would distract us from the real threats we face. When John McCain said we could just muddle through in Afghanistan, I argued for more resources and more troops to finish the fight against the terrorists who actually attacked us on 9/11 and made clear that we must take out Osama bin Laden and his lieutenants if we have them in our sights. John McCain likes to say he'll follow bin Laden to the gates of hell, but he won't even go to the cave where he lives." And that's your Obama hero. Again from Global Research, The Nation. In the Obama campaign, the special convention issue of The Nation magazine features a lengthy article entitled "Progressives in the Obama Movement," or moment, not sure if that's a typo, which seeks to make the case for those opposed to war and the reactionary policies of the Bush administration to rally behind the campaign of Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama. The authors of the article engage in verbal contortions in an attempt to square the notion that Obama represents a progressive anti-war impulse of far-reaching dimensions. Quote, "The Obama nomination sets the stage for a sea change election." With the plain fact, try and square it, that with the plain fact that his actual policies are of a thoroughly conventional character and are well within the confines of the right-wing consensus of American bourgeois politics. So now from Lou Rockwell, "Both parties want dictatorship. Politics brings out the worst in everyone, which is one good reason to completely depoliticize society. This way we can all busy ourselves in productive work or leisure instead of wasting vast time watching these clowns on TV promise the impossible to us. What we're being offered on television is two flavors of dictatorship. And this is truncated for you. One party imagines Athens with fairness and justice for all, international brotherhood and sisterhood, a world free of hate and discrimination in which all wealth is shared and no wealth is made at the expense of nature. Now to the Republicans, who imagine themselves creating a modern form of Sparta with military strength and a disciplined citizenry unified in the drive to national greatness, courage, and heroism. Along with this comes support for national service, the draft, and a demand that Congress stop meddling in executive branch matters. Two sides, same coin. Here's an interesting note, and I stole this video from your4state.com, and it's up on youtube.com/mediamonarchy. Obama strategists mark West Virginia as a battleground state.
Now to the latest from the Barack Obama campaign. Fresh from the Democratic National Convention, strategists have now fixed their eyes on West Virginia. NBC 25's Mary King explains why the state is now more important and worthy of more attention from Obama.
During the primary season, presidential candidate Barack Obama suffered one of his biggest losses here in the state of West Virginia. The Obama campaign is now refocusing its efforts. They're now labeling West Virginia a battleground state.
They plan to send at least 22 persons into the state. They're gearing up for at least 3 or 4 offices, maybe more.
Kay Brzee is the vice chair of the Democratic Party in Jefferson County. She, as well as other local Democrats, have recently learned that the Obama campaign has moved West Virginia up on its priority list.
One of the delegates said this week that West Virginians want to be asked for the vote, and that they will vote for you, but you need to ask for it. And my biggest disappointment during the primary was that Obama did not come here.
Which Kern says could explain why Obama lost by so much in the state Democratic primary. But the party's planning to turn that around, getting experienced staffers and potentially the candidate to the state.
They expect and are working on and feel very confident about getting either Bill or Hillary Clinton, Obama himself, or Senator Biden.
The state's executive director confirmed that the latest poll numbers had McCain leading in West Virginia, but that's not stopping the local volunteers.
Because one of the things that I've since learned about the polls is they're calling landlines. And as you know, there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of young people who have registered, and they're on cell phones.
Brzee says she's glad the campaign is finally fighting for West Virginia, and she hopes that in November it shows.
We really need the presence of the national campaign here, and we're just thrilled that they're considering us a state, a battleground state. And it's going to be a battle, believe me.
And I guess staffers are acknowledging that the campaign will be a lot of work. President George W. Bush won the state of West Virginia in 2000 and 2004. In Charlestown, Mary King, NBC 25 News.
The executive director of the Democratic Party in West Virginia says the Obama campaign plans to open its headquarters in Charleston next Thursday and later 4 other offices throughout West Virginia, including one in the Eastern Panhandle.
Where prior to moving to Portland about 3 years ago, I spent a decade of my life in the Eastern Panhandle of West Virginia. And there are many, many drinkers of the Obamasiah Kool-Aid in the Eastern Panhandle. So, Obama strategists mark West Virginia as battleground state. And that's why here on the show in previous weeks and months, I was speculating that we'd see someone perhaps even like Jay Rockefeller get the VP nod. Alas, the man who did was consummate Washington insider Senator Joseph Biden. So, little controversy swirling around him. We've got the back and forth, the tug of war. So, first from Raw Story, Biden would prosecute Bush officials if evidence exists. Fox's Brian Kilmeade talked with Joe Biden about Sarah Palin's speech to the RNC. Kilmeade also asked Biden about reports that an Obama administration would prosecute officials in the Bush administration. And so you can hit up The Guardian and The Telegraph, always the foreign press, about pursuing the Bush administration criminally. So once the brouhaha heated up, Biden denies no one's talking about pursuing Bush criminally. The possibility that Obama might seek to bring criminal charges against Bush or members of administration has been a recurring theme during the presidential campaign, especially since the Obama campaign has attempted to stress the themes of bipartisanship. For that reason, Democrats have been quick to downplay any hints of possible criminal prosecutions. Does that sound familiar? It's off the table. What haven't you got through your head about that yet? It's off the table with these guys. Each administration pardons the guys before them, pats them on the back. Good job. We'll take it from here. 8 years later, other guys pat them on the back. Good job. We'll take it from here. Everybody gets pardoned. Everybody gets a pass. We get fucked. If we jump to Press TV, Biden also says that Israel is free to attack Iran. U.S. Democratic vice presidential candidate Joe Biden says Israel can take any action against Iran without Washington's permission. Quote, Israel has an absolute right to defend itself, Biden told the Jerusalem Post on Wednesday, adding that, quote, it doesn't have to ask us. And I link it over to jpost.com so you can see it. Now, again, let's see if this sounds familiar. This is from The Guardian. Rupert Murdoch brokered secret truce between Obama and Roger Ailes, head of Fox News. Rupert Murdoch helped broker a, quote, tentative truce between Obama and key News Corp Lieutenant Roger Ailes, the boss of Fox News Channel earlier this year, according to the media mogul's biographer. Murdoch, the News Corp chairman and chief executive, was forced to court Obama after the rising star of U.S. politics rebuffed his initial approaches, it is believed, because of what he saw as the derogatory coverage of him and his wife, Michelle, on Fox News, yada, yada, yada. You see Limbaugh, months ago, fronting for Hillary. We know that Rupert Murdoch has had secret meetings with Hillary. Now that Obama's got the nomination, what difference does it make? News Corp and Rupert Murdoch, they know which way the wind blows, and they always position themselves to be on top, whichever way we decide to throw the bums out each 8 years they've been positioned to have you. And of course, overseas on Sky News, they can seem critical. Lastly, on Joe Biden, this from the Associated Press, five, count them, five deferments kept Biden out of Vietnam. Democratic vice presidential nominee Joe Biden received five student draft deferments during the Vietnam War, the same number of deferments received by Cheney. Oh, and he was later disqualified from service because of asthma as a teenager. So, always like the Chicken Hawks, they can send our brothers and sisters and sons and daughters and husbands and wives and mothers and fathers off to fucking die in criminal wars. But when the time comes for themselves to go fight for some criminal wars, some oil pipelines, some opium or poppy or drugs or whatever the hell it is, oh, they just can't go. So, speaking of draft-dodging dirtbags, a clip, a little sneak preview clip, not a trailer in any way, it's just a scene from Oliver Stone's quickly upcoming film W has been released. It's up on Raw Replay, brought to us from ITN, a clip from Oliver Stone's Bush film released. So here it is, it's just a scene. It's basically Josh Brolin as George W. Bush meeting Laura, who I'm not sure the actress is. So here we go, Oliver Stone's W.
Wasted days and wasted.
Laura, come here. I'd like for you to meet George Bush Jr.
Laura Welch.
Call me anything but Junior. What do you do, Laura?
Oh, I read, I smoke.
Uh-huh.
I admire.
You admire what?
People who write, who read. I'm a librarian.
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh.
No, actually, I'm reading something right now. Yeah, a very engaging book.
Oh, what is it?
Barry Goldwater's Conscience of a Conservative.
Uh-oh. Jam!
No, don't tell me.
Well, I worked on Gene McCarthy's campaign and voted for LBJ.
Oh, no. No. Well, looks like we're hitting it off like grease hits a skillet, huh?
Well, I don't think politics should define a human being. There's more to people than just how they vote.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. You're open-minded. Yeah, much more so than me, I'd have to say.
I read in the paper that you're running for Congress.
Yes, ma'am, I am. And I don't believe in forcing myself on people, so that's why I'm just going to ask for your phone number, not your vote.
You're a devil.
When I know that you're not true.
Wasted days and wasted nights. Now, maybe if George would have read Goldwater's conscience of a conservative a little more, we wouldn't quite be in the mess that we are. But anyway, so that's a clip from the quickly upcoming Oliver Stone, George W. Bush biopic W. And I'm not even holding my breath for anything close to something like JFK or even Nixon for that matter. But we'll see. Shifting gears, we're going to hit up 9/11 blogger and historycommons.org for anthrax updates, Ivan's Labs, and Hatfield's predictive programming. So first, by way of 9/11 blogger, they note a terrific column in the Frederick News Post about the flimsiness of the government case against Ivan's. And they implore you to email the author, Catherine Heerbrandt, thanking her for naming the elephant on the grassy knoll. And if you check out the whole story, that basically says, you know, there's no evidence to convict Ivan's. Of course, if he were alive, there's no way they would have been able to convict him, much like Oswald. If he were alive, they would have never been able to convict him because you could never get CE-399 into evidence. But anyway, note that contractor Battelle, with a link for you to read more about them, who received this contract that's mentioned in the article for $750 million, is a tax-exempt organization. No doubt they will use the $750 million to heal the sick and bring comfort to the afflicted. So, pull quote from it. When Norm Covert, a conservative former Fort Detrick public affairs officer, and attorney Barry Kissen, a liberal activist opposing Detrick's biolab expansion, they agree that Bruce Ivan's was not the anthrax killer. Either the world's spinning off its axis or the truth is staring us so hard in the face, we'd have to be blind to miss it. So Covert's piece this week in thetentacle.com establishes what many in our community, including scientists and support staff at USAMRID, USAMRIID, past and present know, that Bruce Ivan's had nothing to do with preparing or sending the anthrax letters. Did you get that? Nothing to do with preparing or sending the anthrax letters. Now, if we jump to historycommons.org, we got a couple flashbacks for you. The first one, if we jump back to September 4th, 2001. New York Times exposes secret U.S. project to create deadly anthrax strain in possible violation of international treaties. A New York Times article reveals that the U.S. has been secretly conducting research on biological weapons that likely violates an international treaty banning the use of biological weaponry. The article by, wouldn't you know it, Judith Miller, our good friend at the New York Times, who would know a thing or two about a thing or two. We've noted, of course, that she was involved in the government PSYOP terror drills pre-9/11 called Operation Dark Winter. And I posted all those videos up to YouTube for you. The article by Judith Miller, Stephen Engelberg, and William Broad is titled U.S. Germ Warfare Research Pushes Treaty Limits. The U.S. signed an international treaty in 1972 that forbids countries from developing or acquiring biological weapons. Did you get that? There's tons of links there for you. They'll kind of freak you out. The prior knowledge is ridiculous. So the next one, the next flashback, also on historycommons.org. We're going to go all the way back to 1998, when our former person of interest, Stephen Hatfill, he wrote a book, you see. He wrote a book back in 1998, and I believe it was called Emergence. It was about a false flag bioweapons attack.
In 1998, scientist Stephen Hatfield writes and copyrights a novel depicting a biological terrorist attack on the U.S. This novel will be one reason why he will be suspected for the 2001 anthrax attacks, before being eventually cleared of any role in these attacks years after suspicion, with a couple links for you to hit right there. The novel, called Emergence, depicts a bubonic plague attack by Palestinian terrorists on the White House and Congress. The bacteria is released in the White House through sprayers installed in a wheelchair, sickening the U.S. president and top congressional leaders. The terrorist is said to be funded by the Iraqi government, and the novel ends with the U.S. attacking Iraq and dropping a nuclear bomb on Baghdad in retaliation. Hatfield envisions the U.S. media whipping the American public into a state of near total hysteria. Quote, whipping the American public into a state of near total hysteria, end quote, over the attack. He apparently asks for help from friends to get the novel to a publisher or an agent, but the help never materializes. The novel will remain on his computer until it's discovered in an FBI raid on his apartment in mid-2002. The FBI will leak details about it to the media in August of 2002. And you can link over and read the original AP report on that. However, one detail will not be made public until an article in Vanity Fair 1 year later, in 03. In a short epilogue in the book Emergence, written by Stephen Hatfield in 1998, a Russian mobster reveals that his own organization, and not Iraq, was responsible for the attack. The mobster says, quote, "The reaction was as great as we had hoped for. The entire focus of the American FBI is now shifted towards combating chemical biological terrorism, and this is allowing us to formulate the unprecedented expansion of our organization." So Hatfield, ahead of the game, as we reposition ourselves to have the Russians, the commies, the Ruskies be the big enemy again. So one of the things to note about this, Stephen Hatfield wrote a manuscript in 98 about a false flag bioterror attack. That kind of reminds me about Martin Keating, brother of Frank Keating, who was the governor of Oklahoma when the OKC bombing happened. Martin Keating wrote a book in the early 90s about Tom McVeigh bombing the Murrah Building. Yeah, it's probably just a coincidence.
The news channel has learned of another strange development. Apparently, before the bombing, Governor Frank Keating's brother, Mark, had been working on a novel about a terrorist bombing in Oklahoma City. Stranger still, one of the characters in the novel was named Thomas McVeigh.
Governor Frank Keating's brother, Martin Keating, wrote The Final Jihad. In the book, a Tom McVeigh masterminds the bombing of the Oklahoma City building. He dedicated the book to the Knights of the Secret Circle, a known Illuminati group. And he wrote the book 2 years before the bombing.
So there's a little clip for you from Alex Jones. You can watch that video and you can make out what the regular newscaster is saying a little better when you can see your lips move. So let's move our lips over to some of the latest on 9/11, all the 9/11 updates. We got Canadian Truth and the New York City Memorial and a key witness suicide. So first, from the Winnipeg Sun, Canadians searching for 9/11 truth. They're going across the country in hopes of tracking down what they say is the real story behind the 9/11 attacks. About 10 members of the so-called Vancouver 9/11 Truth Society rolled into Winnipeg on a small bus while en route from the West Coast to Ottawa, to try and push Canadian authorities to launch a new independent probe of the World Trade Center catastrophe. There's a need for another look at the whole attack, Michael Welch, a Winnipeg resident assisting the Vancouver group, said while pointing to a U.S. commission that investigated the fall of the Twin Towers, in which they go on to point out all the holes. At the end of it, there are things that happen all over the world that our government looks into for us. 24 Canadians died in the towers. That alone should be enough. But if we jump to WHYN AM 560, 9/11 Memorial construction begins in New York City.
Today we installed the first steel beams into the memorial. That is the big sign of progress for this project. These steel beams will frame both the museum that we're building and reflecting absence of the memorial. And it's a big step. Our first focus right now is the 10th anniversary. When the eyes of the world are looking at Ground Zero in a major way again, we want to have this inspiring memorial complete.
Those of us who worked the recovery effort, and we were here when the last column was taken out, we live for this day. And this day is like, it took a long time to get here, but now that it's here, it means we've begun. It means that it's going to flow now. It means that steel's going to go up. It means that we're going to go forward and nothing's going to stop us.
9/11 claims another victim. This from the New York Daily News. After Kenny Johanneman, or Johanneman, it's J-O-H-A-N-N-E-M-A-N-N, after Kenny Johanneman shot himself, relatives found a letter on White House stationery in the one-room apartment he shared only with his cat. And they reprint the text for you. It's a letter from George and Laura Bush thanking him for his work on 9/11. Johanneman was a part-time janitor assigned to clean restrooms in the North Tower on 9/11 and was indeed credited with saving a man. His family says that that day changed him, that he became withdrawn and began drinking heavily, falling in and out of work. 12 days before the 7th anniversary of the day he saved a life, Johanneman took his own life. The police then vouchered another letter, the suicide note the 43-year-old wrote on Sunday afternoon, shortly before 5 p.m., or the 5 p.m. deadline his landlord had set for him to vacate for non-payment of rent. Quote, "The reason I killed myself was because I was getting evicted and I can't handle being homeless. I'm very depressed since I was in 9/11. I've been drinking way too much and it's ruined my life. I've lost friends and family over drinking and I'm very lonely. There's nothing left for me to be happy about other than my cat. Sounds weird, but it's true. I just wanted to say sorry to any people I ever hurt in my life. I really was a good person when I wasn't drinking. I hope people remember that. Goodbye, Kenny Johanneman." On a separate sheet was a plea, quote, "Please find my cat a home. His name's Papa Boy, and he's a very special cat." Now, initially, it just broke my heart, which it still does. However, when I got home this morning, I saw a little update that kind of gave me a little context to this. So, from Brass Check TV, their take is, key 9/11 eyewitness commits suicide, in quotes. The Daily News reported yesterday that Kenny Johanneman, a key witness in the World Trade Center 9/11 bombings, recently committed suicide. I call him a key witness because in spite of aggressive prodding from reporters about the planes, he clearly called what happened on the upper floors of the World Trade Center explosions.
We should be able to hear what this man is saying now.
Anything else that you saw? Were you there for the second hit by the plane?
About 10 minutes later, the second building went off.
Did you see it?
Yes, I saw it. It just blew up. A big explosion. People started running. It was just chaos everywhere. People jumping out. People just kept jumping and jumping and jumping. And you could still see they were alive because they were flailing around.
The FBI has already stepped in to investigate. It could be possibly a terrorist strike.
It could be. It could be because it was the first one went off and then 10 minutes later, this just blew up out of nowhere.
Hard to think that would just be accidental.
No, I don't think it would be accidental.
Back it up, folks. Back it up. Back it up. Take point. Do it.
Kenny?
Johanneman.
Spell your name.
J-O-H-A-N-N-E-M-A-N-N.
And you were working there?
Yes, I was right there. I was down in the basement. Came down, all of a sudden the elevator blew up, smoke. I dragged the guy out, his skin was hanging off, and I dragged him out and I helped him out to the ambulance.
Thank you, right?
Now that's the same story that our man William Rodriguez tells. Explosion, plane hits. They were already treating their friend with the skin hanging off his arms before the plane hit. So, however went down, my man, Kenny Johanneman, we salute you, brother. And we're going to move on to the world of geopolitics. Georgia, Israel, Thailand, India, Pakistan, Mexico, and more. First up from The Guardian, Darth Cheney visits Georgia in show of solidarity. And I believe even since I posted this up, he's done more saber-rattling. The U.S. Vice President arrived in Tbilisi in a show of political backing for the nation and its pro-Western Georgian president. Dick Cheney's visit comes a day after the White House announced a $1 billion economic aid package for Georgia, which was ravaged by last month's war with Russia. The trip and his meetings with President Mikhail Saakashvili today have raised speculation that a U.S. military aid package might be announced soon. Georgia has been a significant troop contributor to U.S. operations in Iraq. Cheney arrived after a trip to neighboring Azerbaijan, where he said the U.S. had a, quote, deep and abiding interest in the nation's stability. We jump to the AP. Russia closes Georgian embassy. Russia closed its embassy in Georgia and halted consular operations after Georgia severed diplomatic ties following last month's war. If we jump to one from Kurt Nemo, deluded Saakashvili expected U.S. and Israel to act as knights in shining armor. According to UPI editor-at-large Arnaud de Borchgrave, Georgia miscalculated in its attack on South Ossetia, and that link is there for you. It's also on Middle East Times. So they miscalculated and bad. Quote, NATO guarantees that an attack against one member country is an attack against all are no longer what they used to be. Had Georgia been inside NATO, a number of European countries would no longer be willing to consider an attack against their own soil. In other words, a lot of people in Europe see the insanity of going up against Russia with its nukes only minutes away from Brussels, Paris, Berlin, etc. Georgia, with its tie-eating leader and deranged ethnic nationalism, simply was not worth it. If we jump to Rio Novosti, Georgia mobilizes commando units near South Ossetia. Georgia is mobilizing commando units near its border with South Ossetia. Russia officially recognized South Ossetia and Abkhazia as independent states on August 26, saying the move was needed to protect the regions after Georgia's August 8th attack on South Ossetia. Georgia's attack, they went first. RussiaToday.com has Georgia admitting they dropped cluster bombs. And you can hit some of the flashback links in there to read about all the other nations that love cluster bombs, like the U.S. and China and Russia. The Georgian government has admitted dropping cluster bombs in its military offensive to regain control of South Ossetia, reports Human Rights Watch. And we link to their report as well. The international organization says it received an official letter from Georgia's defense ministry that acknowledges the use of the M85 cluster munition near the rocky tunnel linking South Ossetia with Russia. The M85 is the same weapon that was used extensively by Israel in its 2006 war with Hezbollah in Lebanon. Human Rights Watch has also said that Russia used the widely condemned weapons in several places during the conflict. Moscow has rejected the accusations, but like I just said, if you hit that link, you can read about how U.S., China, and Russia avoided international treaties and roundtable meeting groups about banning cluster bombs. From the AP yet again, Russia says U.S. delivered weapons to Georgia under the cover of humanitarian aid. Russia warned the West on Monday against supporting Georgia's leadership, suggesting that the United States carried weapons as well as aid to the ex-Soviet Republic and calling for an arms embargo until the Georgian government falls. If we jump again to Rio Novosti, Russia, quote, could destroy NATO ships in the Black Sea within 20 minutes. Russia's Black Sea fleet, with a link for you to read more about that, is capable of destroying NATO's naval strike group currently deployed in the sea within 20 minutes, a former fleet commander said last Friday. Russia's general staff said on Tuesday there were 10 NATO ships in the Black Sea, 3 U.S. warships, the Polish frigate General Pulaski, the German frigate FGS Lubeck, and the Spanish guided missile frigate Admiral Juan de Borbon, as well as 4 Turkish vessels. And 8 more warships are expected to join the group. I believe there's also War Games. I don't have that linked up yet. You can hit up blacklistednews.com and read about the Shanghai Cooperation Organization doing War Games right now. But if we jump to Winter Patriot, dissident Russian website owner shot dead by the police. The owner of a dissident Russian website has been shot dead after being detained by the police. Magomed Yevloviev was apparently shot in the temple while in police custody in what the police are calling an accident. I shouldn't laugh while I fumble over these names because it's fucking important, so I apologize. His website, with a link for you, was very critical of the Kremlin. The government had made repeated attempts to shut it down. So if at first you don't succeed, and Winter Patriot notes that there's much more to the story, and you can hit up links here and here and here as good places to start. We return to Press TV and move on to Israel. Israelis shoot Palestinian man with learning disabilities in the face with rubber bullets. A Palestinian has been critically wounded after Israeli troops shot him in the face in an overnight raid in the West Bank village. The military forces attacked the village where there has been weekly demonstrations against Israel's controversial separation barrier. During the operation, 40-year-old Awad Sarur, last name S-R-U-R, Srur, was shot with 4 rubber-coated bullets, 3 of which struck him in the face, according to doctors treating him at a hospital in the nearby town of Ramallah. You can link over to The Guardian for more documentation on that story. The People's Voice has an article asking you to imagine John Lennon's response to Paul McCartney's Friendship First concert in Israel. 40 years ago, Israel banned the Beatles, fearing their revolutionary message of love and peace would corrupt their youth. On September 25th, 2008, Sir Paul McCartney will perform his Friendship First concert in Tel Aviv for $4.3 million, and it's being promoted as, and he is being promoted as music's most revered stars and a holder of the key principles of friendship, loyalty, and respect. And as I wondered what Lennon might have said to his old mate in regards to making money from an apartheid state, I reminisced to revolution. If we jump to thinkprogress.org, a poll says that 55% of Americans support Israeli strike on Iran. A recent poll released by the Israel Project claims that 55% of Americans would approve the United States and its allies making targeted conventional military strikes against Iran's nuclear weapons facilities. That number rises to 63% if economic and diplomatic sanctions fail and Iran acquires nuclear capability. And also, if a frog had wings, yada yada. The Israel Project released the findings at a press conference this week with pollster Frank Luntz, our good buddy Frank Luntz, the master of semantics and verbal and mental gymnastics and all the focus groups you can handle. You should Google Frank Luntz. L-U-N-T-Z, who suggested that the reason for the high numbers was simply that Iran scares people. Still, there was a great deal of support for diplomacy, with 62% saying an opportunity for diplomatic solution still exists. So if we return to Press TV, Israel says when we attack, when we say we're going to attack, we mean it. Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak says Israel's determined to use any option to stop Iran's nuclear program should sanctions fail. The time is still for diplomacy and sanctions, but much more effective sanctions. We keep saying that we do not remove any option from the table. I propose to others not to remove any option from the table as well. But when we say it, we mean it. Returning to the Associated Press and jumping to Pakistan, which now apparently de facto special ops were in Pakistan. Brzezinski wins again. While he pulls the strings to bring in his puppet. At least 15 people, including women and children, were killed in an attack involving U.S.-led forces in a remote Pakistani village near the border with Afghanistan. The U.S.-led coalition in Afghanistan said it had no report of such an incursion, said to have happened in the militant-infested South Waziristan tribal region. Pakistan's army confirmed an attack but did not specify if it believed foreign troops were involved. Here's an update from the New York Times. U.S. Special Ops Attack Iran. Helicopter-borne American Special Operations Forces attacked al-Qaeda militants in Pakistani village near the border with Afghanistan early Wednesday in the first publicly acknowledged case of the United States forces conducting a ground raid on Pakistani soil. There you go. We're in. It's on. Dutch newspaper is reporting that a U.S. attack on Iran is imminent. Now, of course, we've heard this before, but who knows which way the wind blows on any given day. Holland's largest newspaper, Telegraaf, reports that a decision has been made by the United States to attack Iran in the next few weeks. Targets include both nuclear facilities and military installations. UAVs will be used in the attack. That's unmanned aerial vehicles, drones. The Dutch Secret Service, the AIVD, has allegedly helped with target mapping. Telegraph claims the AIVD has collaborated with the U.S. in sabotaging the Iranian weapons industry. Deemed successful, these operations were recently halted because of the U.S. plan for airstrikes. AIVD information over the last few years has been shared with the CIA. Moving again to international geopolitics, as nations and states around the world begin to shake to their foundations and the people spill into the streets. Thai protesters flout Premier's state of emergency. Thailand's embattled leader struggled to keep the peace and his grip on power Tuesday after declaring a state of emergency that was openly flouted by thousands of anti-government protesters in the capital. While Prime Minister Samak Sundaraj sought to tamp down on newly violent unrest pitting pro- and anti-government protesters, he was also hit by an electoral commission with findings that could disband his party and bar him from politics. Let's hear a clip and see if we can straighten my mess out on Thailand's states of emergency.
Mayhem on the streets of Bangkok, the worst violence the Thai capital has seen in years. Trying to rein in the chaos, the Prime Minister, Samak Sundarawit, has declared a state of emergency in Bangkok. He addressed the nation and said the emergency action will not last more than a few days.
Life will going on as usual, but we have arrived to do something for those who perform what has happened in the Prime Minister's office. That's the only way to solve the problem. We must declare emergency.
And he's put the army commander in charge of keeping order in the capital. All public gatherings are banned, and there will be restrictions on media reporting, which the government says undermines public security. The violence broke out shortly after midnight, when government supporters pushed through the police line. They battled with the anti-government protesters, the People's Alliance for Democracy. Both angry sides were armed with sticks, clubs, and catapults. In the chaos, several people who had fallen to the ground were severely beaten. At least one person was killed, and many more injured. The crisis began a week ago, when protesters occupied a seat of the government in Bangkok. They're calling for the Prime Minister Samak Sundarawit to resign. They accuse him of being a front for the exiled former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat, which Samak has refused. But the pressure is piling on the Thai Prime Minister. Last week, the well-funded network of protesters crippled the transport system, leaving thousands of tourists stranded. The public sector unions have threatened more action with a nationwide strike on Wednesday. But with a state of emergency now declared, it's not clear whether they'll back down. Meanwhile, the anti-government protesters occupying Prime Minister's office say they're not leaving. Vanessa Heaney, BBC.
Straight to that story, and the situation is degenerating in Thailand. At least one person has been killed and 35 others injured following clashes between supporters of Prime Minister Samak Sundaravit and anti-government demonstrators demanding his resignation. Nelson Rand is our correspondent in Bangkok, and he now joins us on the line. Nelson, this is undoubtedly the worst violence since the anti-government protests began.
Yes, that's right. Absolutely. I'm at the scene of the latest clashes right now. I'm actually standing in between a group of pro-government supporters and riot police. Now, it is 4 in the morning in Bangkok. The details are still quite sticky, but what I'm hearing now is that at least 35 people have been injured and at least one dead after anti-government protesters clashed with pro-government supporters over the last couple of hours. Now, it happened when a pro-government crowd broke through several lines of police and confronted anti-government protesters. The two sides apparently threw stones and wooden planks at each other before the riot police were called in to break them up.
Nelson, what are the Thai authorities doing at this time to quell the tensions between the pro- and anti-government supporters?
Well, the Thai army has sent 4 companies of soldiers into the area to assist with the police. Now, this is the first time that the army has been called in to maintain order in the week-long standoff after anti-government supporters broke through the area of the government house and have been occupying that area since Tuesday. Now, these clashes come about 24 hours after an emergency parliamentary session where lawmakers tried to come up with a solution to end the crisis. However, no solution was found from this meeting. The Prime Minister refused to resign, as what the protesters are demanding, and instead he said that he would try to find democratic measures to adhere to the crisis.
State of emergency in Thailand, India as well. Worst floods in over 50 years. You can link over. There's slideshow and more from time.com, but also from China. This is from the Washington Post. Quake brings grim repetition to China. It was a familiar scene. Rescue teams headed into an earthquake zone Sunday to help tens of thousands of frightened farmers deal with hundreds of aftershocks and shortage of tents. Less than a week after the close of the Olympic Games, which brought mostly good news to China's government, officials struggled with the aftermath of a 6.1 magnitude earthquake that killed at least 32 people and injured hundreds last Saturday. If we jump to Japan, Japanese Prime Minister resigns. Japan's unpopular Prime Minister, Yasuo Fukuda, F-U-K-U-D-A, announced his resignation Monday after less than a year in office. Fukuda, in a hastily arranged news conference Monday night, said he was stepping down to avoid, quote, a political vacuum at the head of the world's second largest economy. My decision is based on what I thought the future political situation ought to be, Fukuda said. But now, returning to the States, returning to my state of Oregon, this being covered in the Oregonian today and previously, but the latest I have is that six Mexican cops have been jailed in an Oregon man's death. Mexican prosecutors are taking the unusual step of jailing six policemen from the resort town of San Jose del Cabo for what they say could be 30 days or more while they investigate how and whether a vacationing Oregonian was beaten to death in officers' custody. Stephen Royster, spokesman for the U.S. State Department's Bureau of Consular Affairs, said Tuesday that last week's death of 38-year-old Sam Botner, B-O-T-N-E-R, of Yoncala was, quote, a grave concern. The State Department is monitoring Mexico's investigation.
A local couple's first ever trip to Mexico ends tragically with his death, and for now, they have a lot of questions for Mexican authorities about just what happened. Thanks for joining us tonight for News Source 16 at 5 o'clock. I'm Renee McCullough.
And I'm Matt Templeman. This happened while the couple was vacationing in San Jose del Cabo in Mexico. Now, Sam Botner was arrested after a confrontation with a local man. It's the last time that Kim Botner would see her husband alive. News Source 16's Megan Higgins is live in the newsroom tonight. And Megan, will the woman find out more about her husband's death anytime soon?
Matt, 38-year-old Sam Botner of Yoncala died the night of August 27th. The cause is unclear, and the death is under investigation. But according to his wife, Kim, several Mexican police officers have been arrested. Now she's waiting for more information. Kim and Sam Botner arrived in San Jose del Cabo, Mexico, August 23rd. Kim says her husband got into an argument with a local man at the resort they were staying at. The argument escalated quickly, and the police were called. Mexican papers reported that Botner was trying to rob the man. His wife says that isn't true. Kim Botner says the whole situation was a misunderstanding, and it didn't help that there was a language barrier. Sam Botner was arrested. The next morning, his wife was told he had died. Kim Botner says the death is now considered a homicide investigation. Instead of flying home together Sunday, Kim identified her husband's remains and flew home alone.
It was hard. I have the images in my brain. I'll always be there. They beat him up bad. They beat him to death. First, I was in shock, and now the anger part is just, yeah, I'm outraged, you know. It was so unnecessary.
Sam Botner grew up in Yoncala. He was a commercial fisherman and timber cutter. Kim says he loved the outdoors, and the couple has three daughters between them. A funeral is set for Saturday at the Assembly of God Church in Yoncala. The service will start at 2, and the public is invited. Meantime, Kim Botner has pressed charges against the police officers involved. She says she's now deciding what to do next. Matt?
Shocking story. We'll stay on top of it. Thank you very much.
Sam Botner, God love you. As if you needed any more evidence that the war on terror is a complete fucking fraud, let's just look south of the border. So first, let's hit the Washington Times. Mexican drug wars threaten U.S. An escalating turf fight between warring drug cartels in Mexico is spreading into the U.S. with federal officials warning that deadly shootouts and ambushes along the southwestern border pose a serious threat to both U.S. law enforcement and American citizens, according to a confidential multi-agency government report. The August 29th report predicts a rise in the use of deadly force against U.S. police officials, first responders, and residents along the border, and further spillage of drug gang violence deeper into the United States, which happens a lot in Texas, but it's kept real quiet. Written by the Arizona Counterterrorism Information Center with a link to them, and the High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area with a link to them, in their investigative support center. The report also said the drug cartels are expected to hire members of deadly street gangs now in this country, including MS-13, to carry out acts of violence against cartel members in the U.S. U.S. law enforcement and first responders need to maintain a heightened awareness at all times. Now, if we jump to the AFP, almost 1,000 deaths this year in Mexico border city. Mexicans plan mass protests against insecurity on Saturday, but not in the city with the highest murder rate this year, where many are focused on more immediate safety concerns. Violence has escalated throughout Mexico since President Felipe Calderon, who took office at the end of 2006, launched a military crackdown on drug trafficking, but nowhere more than in Ciudad Juarez. Ciudad Juarez. So, if the war on terror were real, we would probably go after that. Lastly, in this batch of geopolitics, this from the Washington Post, Ecuador giving U.S. airbase the boot. When U.S. officers stationed in this humid coastal city give reasons they should continue their decades-old airborne surveillance mission, they talk not about fighting drug runners on the open seas, but about the $71 million they've spent to renovate and maintain the city's airport and the $6.5 million they inject each year into the local economy. But the government of Ecuador has decided, and Washington has apparently agreed, that one of the most important foreign outposts in the United States' war on drugs will close. The 450 U.S. Air Base personnel, or rather the 450 U.S. Air Force personnel and contractors stationed at a military base that shares the airport's runway, will be leaving next year. And if you know anything about Barry Seal and drug running, you know that it's usually centered around airports. So that smells nice and stinky. But we're going to move on. As we mentioned, Sam Botner, it's possible he died of a new syndrome. Okay, get this. This is a 10 on the bullshit-o-meter. Bullshitometer. Sudden death after arrest may be a new syndrome. This is from Reuters. And before I get to the article, I'll just tell you that sudden death after arrest may be a new syndrome. Yeah, it's called policius brutalis. And it's similar to the unusual event that caused Building 7 to fall. Or, what about that woman who strangled herself in the airport? Young men who die suddenly after being arrested by the police may be victims of a new syndrome similar to the one that kills wild animals when they are captured, Spanish researchers said on Tuesday. Manuel Martinez-Sales of Madrid's Hospital Gregorio Maranham reached the conclusion after investigating 60 whole cases of sudden unexplained deaths in Spain following police detention. In one-third of the cases, death occurred at the point of arrest, while in the remainder, death was within 24 hours. And Dr. Celas told the annual meeting of the European Society of Cardiology all this, with a link for you. All but one of the casualties were male, and their average age was just 33 years, with no previous history of cardiovascular disease. Something unusual is going on, Celas said. Just why they died remains a mystery, but he believes young men in particular may experience surges in blood levels of chemicals known as catecholamines, with a link for you. When under severe stress, adrenaline is one of the most abundant catecholamines. And if you believe that, my friends, I have a large, beautiful bridge for sale. If we jump to the AP, Canada to compensate atomic soldiers with, quote, pathetic pittance. And if you don't know what atomic soldiers are, you better Google it. You don't think the government would pull off black ops on its people? Hundreds of former Canadian soldiers will receive compensation for being assigned to participate in atomic bomb tests by the U.S. and British militaries in the 1960s, the Defense Ministry said September 2nd. Defense Minister Peter MacKay said the soldiers were involved in operations in the U.S., Australia, and the South Pacific from the end of World War II until the International Treaty Banning Atmospheric Test Explosions was signed in 1963, with a link for you. Canada's government will also compensate former military personnel who assisted with emergency decontamination efforts at the Chalk River nuclear plant in Ontario following two major nuclear reactor accidents in 1952 and 58. The participants have received no recognition for their dangerous assignments in the service of Canada, McKay said during a speech. In total, 900 former soldiers or families of deceased veterans will receive payments of $22,000 each. Wow, $22,000 for being assigned to sit in front of a nuclear blast. It just gets uglier by the second. This, again, from the Associated Press. This isn't crazy, it's all the Jews conspiracy theory bullshit. This is their headline, the Associated Press. Israeli Mossad let Nazi Mengele get away. Israeli agents who kidnapped Nazi mastermind Adolf Eichmann from Argentina in 1960 found the notorious death camp Dr. Joseph Mengele, but let him get away, one of the operatives said Tuesday. Mengele was one of the most wanted Nazi war criminals, a doctor who conducted cruel experiments on twins and dwarves at the Auschwitz concentration camp and killed kids with lethal injections. He selected prisoners who would be subjected to his experiments and sent others straight to their deaths in gas chambers. Rafi Eitan, R-A-F-I-E-I-T-A-N, with a link for you. He's got a Wikipedia entry. Hell. Now an 81-year-old Israeli cabinet minister told the AP on Tuesday that he and other Mossad agents located Mengele living in Buenos Aires with his wife at the time of Eichmann's capture in 1960. The boys from Brazil are little Hitlers. But they decided that trying to nab him would risk sabotaging the capture of Eichmann, who implemented Adolf Hitler's final solution to kill European Jewry and was deemed a more important target. Now, of course, we noted that IBM and the Hollerith punch card machines helped the final solution. Remember, IBM is the final solutions company. It was known that Mengele was living in Buenos Aires around the time of Eichmann's capture, but Eitan's comments indicated that Israelis were closer to him than had previously been thought, and shed light on why they decided to abandon an attempt to catch him. When you have one operation, you're taking a certain level of risk. If you're doing a second operation at the same time, you double the risk, not only for the second op, but for the first one as well. Now, of course, you should check out Operation Paperclip and Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. We did not defeat the Nazis. We defeated the Germans, but we did not defeat the Nazis. And Jim Mars, in his new book, makes the case that we are the rise of the Fourth Reich. Returning to the Washington Times, haven't heard anything about this scumbag in a little while, but Alberto Gonzalez mishandled 18 classified documents on his first day at work. The Justice Department's internal watchdog said Tuesday that former Attorney General Alberto R. Torture Gonzalez had only been on the job a few hours the first time he mishandled highly classified documents. All told, a report from the Justice Department Inspector Glenn Fine concluded that Mr. Gonzalez failed to properly secure 18 top-secret documents related to National Security Agency surveillance and detainee interrogation programs. Surveillance and torture. The report is the latest in a series from Mr. Fine's office that have been highly critical of Mr. Gonzalez and the Justice Department under his leadership. Gonzalez resigned in 07 after two tumultuous years at his post, but whereas previous reports found concerted efforts by staff to fill department ranks with conservatives or Republicans, the latest report suggests carelessness. Oh, it's incompetence. And they go on to talk about the classified documents on the NSA surveillance program and the Justice Department's National Security Division and on and on. But speaking of lies and obfuscation, if we jump to U.S. News and World Report, contradiction on spy satellite shoot down explanation. If you recall, several months ago, we covered the spy satellite shoot down PSYOP. And this is all posted up under the heading Spy Sat Shoot Down Lies, Surveillance in a Box, and Vidal. So first, contradiction on spy satellite shoot down explanation from U.S. News and World Report. When the Pentagon ordered a Navy ship to shoot down a crippled U.S. spy satellite last February, it claimed the operation was necessary to prevent harmful fuel from being dispersed into the atmosphere. At the time, critics charged that the Bush administration was using the toxic fuel as an excuse to demonstrate missile defense and anti-satellite capabilities, now there is new evidence that the critics were very likely right. With a link for you to read about the whole SpySat psyop. Astrophysicist Yousef Butt, with the unfortunate last name of B-U-T-T, astrophysicist Butt obtained U.S. government documents showing that NASA's own analysis concluded that the satellite's fuel tank was expected to burn up completely during re-entry, even though NASA probably overestimated the tank's chances of survival. Despite its optimistic oversimplifications, the release study indicates the tank would certainly have demised high up in the atmosphere. But a staff scientist at the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics writes in an article for the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, and I link, you can read his whole article. So again, lies. But if we jump to Tom Burkhart on IntelDaily.com, new spy software coming online, Surveillance in a Box, makes its debut. You've heard of the FBI's Quantico Circuit, with a link for you to read about that. You've heard of FBI's Quantico Circuit and were outraged by illegal warrantless wiretapping by Bushist minions. To no avail, you flooded Congress with emails and phone calls, angered by the bipartisan FISA amendments of 2008. You know, Obama voting for retroactive immunity to the telecoms for spying on us. And, of course, the swell party thrown last week by AT&T for Blue Dog Democrats in Denver. But just in time for a new administration and the bundles of cash always at the ready for expanding homeland security market, comes a complete surveillance-in-a-box system called the Intelligence Platform. According to New Scientist, German electronics giant Siemens has developed software allegedly capable of creating, quote, tasks typically done by separate surveillance teams or machines, pooling data from sources such as telephone calls, email and internet activity, and bank transactions and insurance records. It then sorts through this mountain of info using software that Siemens dubs intelligence modules. New Scientist reports that the firm has sold the system to some 60 countries in Europe and Asia. Which countries? Well, Siemens won't say. If we jump back to Press TV and our man Gore Vidal, U.S. never had a democracy. American essayist Gore Vidal says that despite the U.S. claim that it's making the world safer by perpetuating democracy, the country never had any democracy. In an exclusive interview with Press TV correspondent, Gore Vidal said that the United States has never had democracy, and the word never was used in the U.S. Constitution, Bill of Rights, or the Declaration of Independence. Vidal also said that America has fallen into the hands of a small group of people that only care about global dominance and making money from U.S. taxpayers by waging wars. Gore Vidal, U.S. never had a democracy. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the democracy. Wait. Oh. It's a republic. Damn. If we now return to the ISP I love to hate, it's Comcast Caps and Surveillance Psychosis and Microchip Cheese. But first, from AP, Comcast to make monthly internet cap official. Comcast, the nation's second-largest ISP, Thursday said it would set an official limit on the amount of data subscribers can download and upload each month. On October 1st, the cable company will update its user agreement to say that users will be allowed 250 gigs of traffic a month. And I can link you over to their press release saying as much. Comcast has already reserved the right to cut off subscribers who use too much bandwidth each month without specifying exactly what constitutes excessive use. And the update on that, from a threat level, Comcast appeals FCC throttling order. Comcast yesterday, Thursday, the 4th, appealed, with a link to their PDF appeal, they appealed the FCC's order that it stop its controversial practice of throttling file sharing traffic. On August 1st, FCC commissioners concluded on a 3-2 vote that Comcast monitor the content of its customers' internet connections and selectively blocked peer-to-peer connections using the BitTorrent protocol. The commission found that Comcast violated so-called rules of net neutrality. Now, we talked about the new syndrome of sudden death when you're arrested, but there's another one. It's a surveillance psychosis. This again from Threat Level. Surveillance society sparks psychosis. or as Cryptagon puts it. So now there's a psychiatric designation for people who are aware of things like the NARIS Insight Intercept Suite and Siemens' aforementioned intelligence platforms. So if you know how they do all these things, oh, you're just crazy paranoid. But let's hear. If you think someone's watching you, you're probably right. But this doesn't mean you're not also crazy. According to psychiatrists who say that our surveillance and reality TV society is spawning a new kind of psychosis, they're calling it the Truman Show delusion. Psychiatrists in the US and Britain say they're seeing a growing number of psychotic patients who are paranoid that cameras are watching their every move. Not sure why they might think that, with a link for you to read about spy cams everywhere. Others fear the World Wide Web is monitoring their lives or being used to transmit photographs or personal information. The psychiatrists say such patients are often mirroring, albeit to an extreme, what is occurring in the environment around them. While that may be true, it's also true that all those things exist. Cameras are watching your every move. The internet is monitoring your life, and it uses your photos and transmits them with your personal info. But you're crazy if you talk about it. See, you know, it's like black helicopters. Oh, you're crazy. But if you see them, oh no, it's good. Or bad in this case. Now, finally, from the New Zealand Herald, New Zealand supermarkets chip cheese and meat with RFID. Supermarkets are introducing electronic tags on items popular with shoplifters and other thieves. The Source Tagging Alliance, ASTA.com.au, set up by leading retailers, is encouraging suppliers to use RFID, radio frequency identification. Encouraging suppliers to use RFID and source tagging on grocery product packaging at the point of manufacture. Retailer Association Chief Executive John Albertson told the Howick and Pakuranga Times, again, this is out of New Zealand, that supermarket chains were introducing electronic source tagging for goods deemed hot for shoplifting. Hot for shoplifting. And if you didn't know, that Campbell's and pretty much everything you get at Walmart has some form of RFID tracking, you better wake up and smell the Campbell soup. Now, if we jump to thesun.co.uk, of course, that bastion of great journalism. But this is something we've discussed before, and that is CERN, or the Large Hadron Collider, LHC. So, asking the question, will the super collider cause the end of the world on September 10th? Scientists are trying to stop the most powerful experiment ever, saying the black holes it will create could destroy the world. Dubbed by some the Doomsday Test, it will be carried out next week, next Wednesday, September 10th. The Large Hadron Collider, located 300 feet underground near the French-Swiss border. The machine is 17 miles long and cost 4.4 billion pounds to create. When its switch is pulled on September 10th, this atom smasher will become a virtual time machine, revealing what happened when the universe came into existence 14 billion years ago. New particles of matter are expected to be discovered, new dimensions found beyond the four known, as scientists recreate conditions in the first billionths of a second after the Big Bang. Experts predict that millions of tiny black holes will be produced, baby brothers of the monsters gobbling up dust and stars at the heart of the galaxies. Now the update from WorldNet Daily. Scientists sue to stop black hole from sucking up Earth. A European court says the idea a new supercollider project could create a, quote, celestial vacuum and eventually consume the Earth is worth discussing, but the project can move forward on schedule anyway. At dispute is what could happen should planned experiments at the supercollider built near Geneva by the European Organization for Nuclear Research, or CERN, go awry when the massive atomic particle smasher is fired up on September 10th. Several scientists, led by spokesman Otto Rosler, a German chemist, have filed a case in the European Court of Human Rights seeking a delay in the project's opening while the potential problems are studied further. And you can hit the flashback and read a little more, like we've covered in previous weeks, about the CERN super collider. So, I suppose we'll find out, or maybe we won't find out because we won't even know. I don't know if it'll be that kind of slow sucking where you feel your face all stretched out as you go into the black hole, or Well, at least I won't have to go to work next Friday. Will the world end on September 10th?
There's no ghost in this machine. I make my own mistakes. We seem like skeletons with bonehead beliefs. History's been crucified. Humans supernaturalized. We hope we're not alone. Exploded stars in space debris taught itself to make some things. Echoes set off. What was there before the bang? How did nothing come to end? At once, let's ask the atheists. Let's ask the atheists, the astronauts, the mystics of the Amazon, the brains, the cults, the witches, the Pope, the crystal ball, the fear of God, the tarot cards, the dowsing rod, theologians, alchemists, black magicians, physicists say, no, say, we don't know. Cults arise from egos, sick with poltergeists and demons.
Machine in the Ghost. That's new music from The Faint off their new record, Fascination. Let's ask the priests, the Pope, physicists, alchemists, Satanists. We don't know. Let's return to the Associated Press and return to my home state of West Virginia, where bastardly chemical companies have had their way for far too long. Bayer pesticide factory explosion in West Virginia kills one. Federal officials are investigating the cause of a plant explosion that rocked an area west of Charleston, hurling a fireball hundreds of feet into the air, killing one worker and injuring another. Among many other chemicals, the Bayer Crop Science plant produces methyl isocyanate, which killed at least 15,000 people in the infamous leak at Union Carbide Pesticide Factory in Bhopal, India in 1984. The name Bhopal synonymous with the Bayer chemical leak. But the chemical was not involved in the explosion, Kanawha County Emergency Management Director Dale Petrie said, and it was stored in steel-wrapped underground containers that were far from the blast. State Department of Environmental Protection spokeswoman Kathy Costco said the primary chemical involved, methyl isobutyl ketone, with links for you to read about all these wonderful chemicals, is highly flammable but not especially toxic. They have a lot of chemicals at the plant, and they do take great steps to protect them, said Joe Thornton, spokesman for the State Department of Military Affairs and Public Safety. I think everything that can be done to protect those chemicals is being done, and I think the public at large is safe. But remember, our Nazi friends at Bayer, remember they were part of the IG Farben monster. And when we beat the Germans, the Nazis paperclipped and everything shattered, and we still have Bayer and IBM and all that. So remember, our Nazi friends at Bayer sold an HIV-contaminated vaccine called Factor 8. And it's the Roman numeral 8. It's kind of hard to find if you just search Factor 8. You need Factor VIII. And you can find a clip from Scarborough Country where they have the wonderful Mike Papantonio on to talk about Bayer shipping a known HIV-contaminated vaccine overseas. They were basically, we can't distribute it here, but hell, we can send it overseas. Bayer knowingly shipped HIV-contaminated vaccines overseas. Fact. A quick obituary. Ike Pappas, who broadcast Oswald's death, dead at 75. Now, of course, he wasn't the only one, but he's one of the more well-known. This, again, from the Associated Press. Ike Pappas, that's P-A-P-P-A-S, a longtime CBS newsman who reported the shooting death of presidential assassin Lee Harvey Oswald on the radio as it was happening, has died at the age of 75. Pappas died Sunday in a hospital in Arlington, Virginia, of complications of heart disease, his family said. Pappas was among the reporters at the Dallas police station waiting for Oswald to be moved 2 days after President Kennedy was assassinated. Pappas had just asked him, "You have anything to say in your defense?" when a shot rang out.
Now the prisoner wearing a black sweater, he has changed from his t-shirt, is being moved out toward an armored car. Being led out by Captain Fritz.
There the horn honk was the signal.
Do you have anything to say in your defense? There's a shot. Oswald has been shot. Oswald has been shot. A shot rang out. Mass confusion here. All the doors have been locked. Holy mackerel. A shot rang out as he was led into his car. The shot was a mass confusion there, rolling and fighting as he was being led out. Now he's being led back. He was thrown to the ground. The police have the entire area blocked off. Everybody stay back. There's the yell. Did you see it?
Eh?
What happened?
Yeah, I saw the guy. There's a man, a rather stocky man with a hat on. A dark...
Stocky man with a hat on?
Yeah, he rushed, he crushed, and he shot him there. And I saw the flash, and Oswald said, oh! And that's it.
Oswald doubled over. There was a big struggle on the ground. Just a moment earlier, I had, no doubt foolishly, jumped in front of him to get in a last question, to ask him what happened, whether he had anything to say in his defense, and then a split second later, the shot rang out.
Now, I don't know if you heard me say, when Oswald's coming out, you hear the horn honk as the signal, because when you look into it, they fudged the car being there. It was supposed to be right at the door. He was never supposed to walk in front of all those people. And, of course, he says, oh, the police have the whole place all locked down. I thought they had it locked down to begin with. How'd Jack Ruby get in there? Oh, that's right. He was friends with all the Dallas cops at the Carousel Club. But I digress. However, let's progress now to what is, I think, the most exciting story of the last week. There's a lot of shit. There's a lot of natural and national disasters and international disasters and the phony left-right paradigm being shoved down our throat. However, 20,000 people gathered in St. Paul, Minneapolis this last week, not for the RNC, or at least not specifically, but for the Rally for the Republic. Ron Paul's Rally for the Republic gathered 20,000 plus in St. Paul. So a lot of reports, a lot of audio and video, a lot of great news surrounding this. Russia Today even noting that Ron Paul steals McCain's thunder. And that clip's there for you. We're not going to hear that one. But the first article from the AP mentions there's no room at the XL Energy Center for Maverick Ron Paul. So his acolytes have packed their cars, hitched rides on Ronvoys, and pitched tents at Ron Stock 08 in Minneapolis in defiance of the GOP convention. So, at the time of this writing, more than 9,700 tickets had been sold for the Rally for the Republic, which seeks to bring together activists who are anti-war, anti-government regulation, anti-taxes, anti-Federal Reserve, anti-outsourcing, anti-individual, or rather, pro-individual liberty, pro-civil liberties, and pro-Ron Paul. So, a lot of the people there, like Jesse Ventura and former New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson, Tucker Carlson, Sarah Evans, Amy Allen, Jimmy Vaughn, Stevie Ray's brother. So this got a lot of news. Between Gustav and between Ron Paul, the only thing anybody paid attention to on the McCain campaign was Sarah Palin. And we'll see how that's going to go. So, like I said, lots of clips. C-SPAN 2 covered the entire Rally for the Republic. And there's everything from the Christian Science Monitor to CNN to the Real News. But let's hear Fox News first.
They're not the only political get-together in the Twin Cities. Former presidential candidate, Republican Congressman Ron Paul, is holding a convention of his own of sorts in the Target Center in Minneapolis this week. His congressional district, by the way, is Galveston, Texas, which could be in Gustav's path. Congressman, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
First of all, let's talk about the hurricane. Obviously, you're concerned if this thing wobbles. It's right on Galveston.
Yeah, that's right, and it's always possible. So I've been watching the cameras on the hurricane as much as anything right now.
Yeah.
It's very important.
Tough for a convention to move forward with this big storm looming.
Right. I think that won't change our plans any, and I can understand people's concern and wanting to express concern for what's happening, but I'm not sure how changing what we do here in Minneapolis will change anything in the Gulf Coast. And it sort of makes the point when you talk in those terms that we sort of have control of the weather, or it's everybody's responsibility.
Y'all, I wasn't going to interrupt. I was just going to roll into the next clip from the Christian Science Monitor, but I forgot he makes the mention of, well, it's not like we control the weather, which, of course, is actually up for debate.
I was at an outdoor concert Monday night that the former GOP presidential candidate Ron Paul threw as a thank you for his supporters. From my conversations there, one thing was clear. Many of his backers are Republicans who feel betrayed by President Bush. In 2000, some told me, they voted for a president who they believed would cut government and steer clear of foreign entanglements. Instead, they watched as government deficits grew and the country entered a messy and seemingly endless war. Enter Ron Paul, the flinty 10-term Texas congressman, who won no primaries but stirred up something of a movement with his unspoken opposition to the Iraq War and his contempt for the federal bureaucracy and diplomatic organizations like the United Nations. There was no question Monday that even after Paul quit the race in June, his people are still fired up. At the concert I went to in a Minneapolis suburb, they waved flags, wore colonial-era costumes, and sold Liberty Dollars, coins made of precious metals that supporters see as in keeping with Paul's endorsement of the gold currency standard. Today, Tuesday, Paul is hosting a Rally for the Republic at the Target Center in downtown Minneapolis that's expected to draw more than 10,000 people, and speakers like former Governor Jesse Ventura of Minnesota and Gary Johnson of New Mexico. The big question is whether Ron Paul Nation is just sound and fury, or whether they could tilt a close election. While many will no doubt vote for the GOP nominee, Senator John McCain, in November, several I spoke to said they would sooner stay home or vote for Libertarian Party candidate Bob Barr or the Constitution Party's Chuck Baldwin. What might help some Paul supporters move to McCain is an endorsement, but Paul has yet to give one, which is one of the reasons he hasn't gotten an invitation to speak at the Republican National Convention here. I'm Ariel Sabar with the Christian Science Monitor in Bloomington, Minnesota.
Thousands of former presidential candidate Ron Paul supporters are attending a counter convention not far away from the XL Center here. The official name of the gathering is the Rally for the Republic, to officially launch Paul's new political action group, the Campaign for Liberty. And Texas Republican Congressman Ron Paul joins me now. It's great to see you again.
Nice to see you.
Always good to have you on.
Thank you.
I want to start off, the report I read this morning that the McCain campaign and the Republican National Committee are actively reaching out to you to try to get your support for Senator McCain's candidacy. Is that true?
I wouldn't put it in those words.
How would you put it?
I imagine, I don't even know where they got a statement like that. I mean, we've been reaching out. We were requesting whether I could come to the floor, and really, we've been just up against the wall.
Oh, so they haven't been reaching out to you?
Well, I wouldn't call it that. I mean, they had one individual come and talk to us, and they said, what would we like? We said, we listed a lot of things and didn't get anything. We said, well, can we go to the floor? And then they said, yeah, you can come under very, very restricted conditions. You know, a Republican congressman should have a pass to the floor. But they said, your pass will be at the gate, and we'll pick it up when you leave, and you can't take anybody with you. I have nobody that can, I mean, my staff, they said we would have three, you know, guest passes that I could take onto the floor with me to have somebody walk with me, but they never confirmed that.
Well, one place you are going to be welcome is at could we call it a counter convention today? What's that all about? What's
well,
the message you want to get
across?
It's
a very positive thing to talk about the issues we think Republicans ought to be talking about. You know, where our problems are, the spending problems, the deficit, our foreign policy, our national defense, our monetary policy, the things that are totally ignored. Personal liberty. Our group don't like the intrusion of personal liberties like the Patriot Act and the Real ID Act. They're not talking about that. So we're saying, you know, if we're Republicans, we believe in limited government and personal liberty, we ought to be talking about these things. And I don't think they're really too interesting.
You have been very critical of Senator McCain's economic policies, his foreign policy, national security policy. You've also been very critical of Senator Obama for the same things. Is there anything to like with either of these candidates for you?
Not a heck of a lot. But
is there anything?
Well, I like it when they shift their positions, but then you don't know where they are. I mean, John McCain used to be for taxes. Now he's against taxes. Obama talks about, you know, less military intervention, but he's the first one to say we should increase the troops in Afghanistan. They both say we should put more money and more investment into Georgia to protect right. that oil line.
But if you don't put more troops into Afghanistan, are you not risking a bigger problem?
Yeah, no, I think we risk very little. I mean, what did the Soviets do? It brought the Soviets to their knees, and we're doing the exact same thing.
Hey, but
we're
you don't almost, think if we pulled out that the Taliban wouldn't become completely resurgent
well,
there?
I have no idea. But I do know that Osama bin Laden would like us to go into Afghanistan because he loves us there because that's exactly what he wants us to do.
Let me ask you something quickly because we're running out of time here. Governor Palin of Alaska had some very nice things to say about you in a recent MTV interview. She called you cool, a good guy, independent of the party machine. What do you think of her and her candidacy?
Well, that sounds like she should be my friend.
Or your running mate.
Yeah, that's good. I haven't met her, but I was delighted to hear that. So I hope she puts the right kind of pressure on our platform and our positions.
Congressman Paul, it's great to talk to you again, as always.
Thank you.
All right, we'll be watching today. See what you got in store.
Thanks a lot.
Sarah Palin thinks Ron Paul is cool. So that was Ron Paul on CNN downplaying reports of negotiations with the McCain team. Now, Jesse Ventura, this by way of 9/11 blogger, Jesse Ventura speaks 9/11 truth to a crowd of 10,000 at a rally. Now, I don't have the pertinent 9/11 clip. I wasn't able to get it in time. However, let's listen to him give a little history about the corruption of the two parties and the debates.
Let's go back in history for a moment, if we may. The year was 1992. And there was a little Texan, another little Texan. We got a Texan here today. But we had another Texan then by the name of Ross Perot who ran. Now, Ross Perot got 1 out of 5 votes. He got 19.7% that year. Well, in 1992, all presidential debates were under the National League of Women Voters, which is essentially a fairly neutral group. You have conservative, you have liberal, you have independents. But what happened after 1992? Here's what happened. Perot scared the establishment so badly that our illustrious Congress took the presidential debates away from the National League of Women Voters, and they created another federal bureaucracy called the National Debate Commission, which I might add happens to be run by the former heads of the Democratic and Republican parties. So what happened when 96 came around? Ross Perot had qualified for nearly $30 million of your tax dollars in the 92 race. Yet, Bill Clinton and Bob Dole got together. Bob Dole did not want Perot in the 96 debates because he felt it would erode from his conservative base. So him and Clinton got together and cut a deal. Clinton agreed because Clinton didn't want debates at all. He was so far ahead, all a debate could do was bring him down. So what happened was the two people cut a deal to eliminate Perot from the 96 debates. They took it to the Federal Debate Commission, and of course it was rubber stamped. So we did not hear Ross Perot in 1996, a person that got 1 out of 5 votes. We were not allowed to hear him. A person that qualified for millions of our tax dollars, we were not allowed to hear him. Why? Because two people made that decision. Now, I ask you, is that what democracy is supposed to be?
Now, as a funny little update and perhaps a little jibe to try and take the wind out of the sails of all this, this from the Associated Press. This was last night. Jesse Ventura endorses a 9/11 conspiracy theorist for Congress. Former Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura has endorsed a September 11th conspiracy theorist for a congressional seat. Ventura came out Thursday in support of Kevin Barrett, a libertarian running against incumbent Democrat Ron Kind for Western Wisconsin's seat. Barrett is a former University of Wisconsin-Madison lecturer who believes the U.S. government was behind 9/11 and has discussed his views in class. Oh my God. But now, thanks to my man C-SPAN Junkie on YouTube.com, we also had Ron Paul appearing for like a half hour on C-SPAN on Washington Journal, where they talked for a while and took calls and more.
And back to St. Paul to be joined by Congressman Ron Paul. Ron Paul, presidential candidate. Good morning, Congressman Paul. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Nice to be with you.
Your fellow Texas delegate, Bill Crocker, who was just on this program, left with a plea for you to throw your support by Senator McCain. Will you do that?
Well, if he changes positions and, you know, goes along with the traditional Republican platform of limited government, balanced budgets and a sensible foreign policy and sound money, you know, I could consider it. But no, he honestly supports positions that I don't support. And so I've worked for these positions for 30 years. It wouldn't make a whole lot of sense for me to support somebody that objects to these positions. I don't think that's likely to happen.
You are in the Twin Cities to hold your campaign for a Liberty rally today in Minneapolis, which for our viewers' information will be covered live on C-SPAN 2 this afternoon beginning at 1:30 Eastern. What's going to happen?
Well, we're going to have a rally, and it's going to be all upbeat. It's all going to be positive to talk about the traditional values of this country, the Constitution, personal liberty, and it's just trying to call attention to the problems that we have and that we haven't addressed as a nation. The Democrats haven't addressed it, and the Republicans haven't addressed it. I mean, we've had control of the White House. We've had control of the Senate and the House and for quite a few years, and we haven't done what we said. I mean, we didn't come up with a balanced budget. I mean, we're so embarrassed that under Clinton, the deficit was less than under the Republicans. There's something wrong. The spending is out of control. The economy is going downhill. And we have a foreign policy that doesn't make any sense whatsoever to any of us. I mean, the neoconservatives have taken over the party and taken over the country. They took over the Democratic Party. And they control the foreign policy. And that is foreign intervention. And we have an empire. We have troops in 140 countries. We have 700 bases overseas. We can't take care of our own people here at home. We blow up bridges overseas. We rebuild these bridges. We can't even take care of the bridges here at home. And we're broke. So the American people are sick and tired of it. 60% to 70% of the American people say they would like to have another choice for president.
Absolutely. So I'm going to have to wrap it up here. There's another clip with Ron Paul on The Real News, and that's up on YouTube. Ron Paul says it's time to end the empire. However, a couple other little articles worth noting is Al Jazeera covered Ron Paul's counter convention call it the real Republican convention. At least that's how Ron Paul and his supporters see the rally for the Republic. Now, we also have, and there's a great clip, you'll have to check it out, from Russia Today with a video up on their YouTube channel. Ron Paul steals McCain's thunder, that basically points out that between Gustav and the rally for the Republic, that the only thing the Republicans had to talk about was Sarah Palin and all her redneck past. Now, here's something of note from the MSNBC, and there's a video to go along with it. You can see all the signs in the background. It's great. Conspiracy theorists unite. And this is a snide little bullshit backhanded article. That's what the dozens of Ron Paul supporters shouting outside the XL Energy Center yesterday afternoon were telling Americans to do. They said the terrorist attacks on 9/11 were an inside job. And like I said, there's video. You can see all the signs there. However, let's jump to the Washington Times and read about black hats keeping a lookout for troublemakers. Fearing demonstrations from Ron Paul delegates here at the RNC, the party has created a, quote, black hat squad to track the Paulites and other potential troublemakers to make sure they don't cause a scene on the convention floor. Identified by their black baseball caps emblazoned with a white star, squad members keep an eye on delegates they fear might cause a scene. The squad is empowered by the convention managers to take delegates' credentials and kick them off the convention floor, a step one convention official said would be unprecedented. Squad members have made their presence known. Okay, no, check this out. Squad members have made, quote, their presence known to let all people know Big Brother's watching them, end quote, said a Republican official familiar with the squad who has been involved in the last 10 GOP conventions. So he would be someone who would know. So there you go. Secret squads tracking Ron Paul supporters. And as I hear the fighter jets scream overhead, it somehow doesn't make me feel more comfortable. But that's going to do it for episode 90 of MediaMonarchy.com. There's a ton more news that I need to go over. So this may spill over to episode 90B. So keep your RSS subscription warmed up and keep an eye out for that. However, let's end this show the way we always end the show, by looking at my StatCounter account and seeing some of the creepy customers coming to MediaMonarchy.com in the past week. And we had places like the Brisbane Catholic Education Society in Australia Google media for concentration camps. We had the SAS Flight Academy out of Latvia Google U.S. weapons in Georgia. Dow Jones Googled Marine who forced sex on recruit gets 4 months prison. The British Antarctic Survey Googled secret bunker, CERN. Hewlett Packard out of Germany also Googled CERN, super collider. We had the Navy Network Information Center hit me up repeatedly from my link on blacklistednews.com. We had the Department of Education out of Charleston, West Virginia asking what is an example of monarchy. And they got more than they bargained for. Boeing out of Seattle hit me up from Strike the Root, still covering the black helicopters over Portland last week for the DOD terror drills. We had the Department of Energy. We had the Homeland Security. We had the Joint Commission on Accreditation. The Navy Network Information Center yet again. Our good Nazi friends at Bayer. They were reading, of course, about their pesticide plant explosion in Charleston, West Virginia. We had Vivendi Universal, we had NASA, Texas Instruments, Bayer again, Ham Radio Outlet Incorporated, the Department of Veterans Affairs, the New York Times, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, Hewlett Packard, Merrill Lynch, Government of the District of Columbia, Googling Russia seized Georgia weapons. We had Dow Chemical from Midland, as in Archer's Daniels Midland. Google Bear Explosion Reasons WV. And finally, we had the Naval Research Laboratory out of Washington, D.C. Google Houston Car Chase September 3rd. And there was some car chase I didn't know anything about. However, the result they got and landed on MediaMonarchy.com was they were reading about the chase in Houston a few months ago where the Houston police gunned down suspected undercover CIA agent Roland Carnaby. And we're going to have to leave it there, my friends. Coming to you every week from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and revereradionetwork.com, as well as KBFR in Boulder and Ground Zero Radio in Atlanta. I implore you to hit me up and make contact on MySpace and Dig and YouTube and Yahoo, IM and Skype and all that with Media Monarchy as your keyword, and the podcast anytime, iTunes, radioforall.net, and archive.org. So join me again, unless, of course, the CERN super collider causes the world to end on September 10th. I'll be back with you for another episode of MediaMonarchy.com. So, like my man Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
Police would get him just the same.